My name is Robert Watson. I'm a member of the FreeBSD core team. As was mentioned, this is my spare time activity. My day job is I'm a research scientist at what is currently McAfee Research. In the past, has been a number of different organizations, including Trusted Information Systems, which did a lot of government research, including the Firewall Toolkit and SMI and all kinds of things. So we have a pretty long history of doing security research. The work I do there right now is largely on operating system research relating to FreeBSD and Trusted BSD. So my day job is related to my hobby, but not quite. So what I'm going to talk to you about is the SMPNG project, which was the SMP next generation project for FreeBSD. FreeBSD has supported SMP for a number of years, but we felt the SMP implementation needed a little bit of retrofitting to scale up more processes. So what I'm going to tell you about is some basic SMP architecture. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about the way the SMP implementation did work and what it is we're in the process of moving to. And what I'm going to do is use the FreeBSD network stack as a case study to try and bring out some of the issues in SMP. So what I'll do is I'll start out by telling you a little bit about what SMP is and multiprocessor systems. And I've tried to make this talk something which people who are kernel hackers might find interesting, but also people who don't have a whole lot of experience with operating systems might find interesting. So I'll sort of start out with some basics and we'll move along from there. I'll talk a bit about how operating systems work in the presence of multiprocessor computing. Then I'll talk about the current and the future SMP architecture. The FreeBSD 3.x and 4.x SMP implementation is mature in the sense that it works quite well, but it doesn't scale up as you increase the number of processors. And so the real challenge is, as you add more processors, how to improve scalability. And then, as I mentioned, I'm going to finish up with the network stack. And I don't assume a lot of background in how network stack works, so I'm going to sort of talk about it at a high level and not go into a whole lot of detail, but try and flesh out some of the ideas. And I will talk a little about some of the optimizations we've been working on. So first of all, multiprocessing is a pretty big area. There's lots of kinds of multiprocessing. And the kind of multiprocessing we're mostly interested in FreeBSD is symmetric multiprocessing, or SMP. What this generally means is that you have one or more general purpose processors in the system. You might have two Xeon processors or four Opteron processors in the system. They're all going to be running the same operating system, acting as peers against the same memory and the same physical resources on the machine. And the real goal of adding more processors is to improve the performance of the system by adding more CPU power. If you just wanted more throughput and you didn't need to have to share the same memory, you buy more computers because that's much more cost effective than using SMP. And if you need to add more CPU power to a particular workload that requires tight integration between the components, then SMP is the way to go. What symmetric refers to is memory performance, the relationship between the processors and system memory and system resources. Symmetric multiprocessing means that performance from any particular CPU to the system memory is about the same as every other processor's performance, every other bit of memory. As I mentioned in a moment, the world is a little bit more complicated than that. Usually, symmetric multiprocessing is compared to NUMA, or non-uniform memory access, in which some memory is closer or faster to access on one CPU than it is on another. And NUMA architectures are much more scalable. You can take into much larger numbers of processes. So as I mentioned, the world is complicated. When we started the SMPNG project, almost 4 years ago, maybe a little bit more, 3-4 years ago. SMP was a fairly simple topic on Intel architectures. Unless you bought very, very, very expensive machines, you could only buy SMP. And they were a relatively small number of processes. And since then, we've had the advent of things like the AMD 64 architecture, when NUMA is something you can actually buy on desktop machines now, which is quite interesting. And so we are interested in NUMA. The other dimension that makes life a little bit more interesting than classic SMP is hyperthreading. Where the difference between processors doesn't have so much to do with memory speed as the fact that they share the same physical resources, and so the work that happens on one logical processor impacts the performance of other logical processors. So it's not along the NUMA SMP dimension so much, but it does make life a little bit more complicated than you have four processors that are running at the same speed. So let me show you a couple of pictures to suggest what it is we are and aren't interested in. This is an example, simplified example, of a pretty plain and ordinary SMP system based on quad Xeon architecture. And the thing to take away from this picture is that each CPU has its own cache, but they all access memory through a single system bus, and they're all equidistant from the memory of the system. So they all get about the same performance in any particular spot of memory until it's in a cache. The caches are different, though, a separate, which means that you need a cache consistency mechanism, and you need to worry about memory consistency. And so that'll come out quite a bit as we move on with the book. The reason that we are interested in NUMA is the AMD 64 architecture. And the difference between SMD and NUMA becomes pretty clear here. In the previous picture, there was one big chunk of memory, all accessed through a single bus. But in the world of AMD 64, memory is actually associated with particular processes. And so the cost to load information from memory is cheaper if you're accessing local memory than memory you have to get through an interconnect. And in the case of AMD 64, the performance difference on small machines between particular CPUs and particular slots of memory isn't all that much, but it is noticeable when you get it right and noticeable when you get it wrong. And so we're increasingly interested in NUMA as time goes by. So here are some things that are not interesting about this project. So a common type of multiprocessing that occurs in desktop systems and workstations is that you have a graphics processing unit, your graphics co-processor. The graphics processor in this picture is pretty different from the remainder of the processes, and then it's hooked up with a separate system bus. Often it won't access the memory directly, you know, memory will move in and out of it, but it sort of lives in its own world off to the side. One of the other important differences is it's not running the same operating system. It may be running an embedded operating system, maybe a special clever processor. And so while this is interesting in the general sense for FreeBSD, it's not interesting from the perspective of the multiprocessor panel. Another thing that we're not specifically looking at, although it is related to SMP, is cluster environments. And this is basically, you know, taking the notion of NUMA a step further, in which memory for different processes becomes substantially further away. So the performance impact of picking the wrong memory or the wrong processor is much more substantial. And in this picture, I've sort of generally referred to interconnect cards, but normally, you know, you'd use InfiniBand or something. And the performance is good, but not good enough that you can just pretend it's an SMP box. And so we're increasingly interested in this sort of thing, but not specifically from the perspective of SMP. So what is actually shared in an SMP system? Almost everything. System memory, PCI buses, I/O channels, pretty much everything you talk to is shared. There's only a very small set of things that aren't shared between the processors, and that's the CPU state itself, the registers, the TLB, which makes life interesting from a VM perspective, a per CPU cache, usually there's a couple of them, of varying speeds, and then there's some other local hardware associated with each processor, such as timers that can be specific to the processor. And as I mentioned, there are sources of asymmetry, even in SMP boxes that you buy off the shelf now, and those include hyper-threading and some amount of uniformity in memory access. So I guess the next question is, what does it mean for an operating system to be MP-capable? And the most simple definition is that the operating system runs on a box with multiple processors. However, that's a little ambiguous as to what that could mean. You can boot a uniprocessor operating system on an SMP box and you see one processor, and that's great. But maybe you're not getting everything out of the box that you wanted. So usually when you talk about an MP-capable operating system, you mean it should be able to run jobs on multiple CPUs. One of the most common approaches for taking a single processor operating system and applying it on a multiprocessor box is something called single system image, in which basically your goal is to make it look like a uniprocessor, you just happen to have more CPU time. And this is actually pretty nice from an application developer perspective, because you don't really have to change your applications all that much to get some of the basic benefits of SMP. So you want it to look like it was before, but you want it to be faster. There are a lot of other models you can use. In cluster environments, you tend to sort of more fall back more on message passing systems and weak memory models and all kinds of things. So single system image degrades as you increase the number of processes, the ability to provide it and have it actually do something useful. At some point, you know, it just runs out. So I'll show you a little bit more about single system image. As I said, the goal is, to the extent possible, to maintain the appearance of a single processor system, only you want more CPUs. And in the case of the work we're doing, what we're trying to do is maintain the current Unix process model. So we're going to offer parallelism by allowing multiple processes to run on different CPUs at the same time, or a single process to run multiple threads on different CPUs at the same time. So depending on the application architecture, you may get parallelism in different ways for user space. And in as much as possible, we want to run all the current applications. And you have to optimize your applications for multiprocessor if you want them to run really well with multiprocessor, but we'd like them to just run. Obviously, the Unix APIs and a lot of Unix services were not entirely designed with parallelism in mind. Some of them are really assume single threading on a single processor, and when you start adding multiple threads on multiple processors, they don't behave all that well. So some change is required. But in general, it actually falls out fairly well. When you're doing multiprocessor work, the goal is really to accomplish higher performance. You're not going to add CPUs to a system if you're not trying to improve CPU performance. However, performance is a pretty vague concept. It really depends on your workload. And some workloads lend themselves very well to multiprocessor operation. Some workloads lend themselves less. And so the kind of workloads you run on large clusters have to be able to run substantial amounts of work in parallel without really communicating with each other, because communication between processes is expensive. And depending on the class of multiprocessor system you have, it is more or less expensive compared to the cost of computation. So when you're trying to evaluate the performance of multiprocessor systems, you have to do it in the context of workloads. So you have to select some benchmarks or some particular applications you want to run, and then optimize with those in mind. The usual way you measure the impact of multiprocessor on a specific application or workload is in terms of speedup. That is, as you add more processors to the system, how much faster does your application get? When you add a second processor, does it double in performance, or does it just go up by a small percentage? And so we're able to score the improvement in performance as you add processors. And sometimes that's a property of the operating system, and sometimes that's a property of the application. So there are really two goals for the operating system as you add more processors. You want them to not get in the way of the application speeding up as you add processors. And you want to facilitate applications getting faster as you add processors by providing primitives that allow applications to make use of multiple processors. And so the ability to run threads out of a single address space on multiple CPUs is a primitive that allows you to make applications run better on multiprocessor systems. So those are really sort of two dimensions of work. So let me talk a little bit more about what speedup means. For the purposes of illustrating this, I've selected a benchmark that involves MySQL on a multiprocessor system. And what I'm trying to compare here is idealized performance compared to real-world performance. So I've selected three data sets as we increase the number of processors. I have a uniprocessor kernel, an SMP kernel running with one processor, two processors, three processors, and four processors. This is an AMD64 machine. And I think one of the things I should point out early on is that when you run an AMD64 platform, the cost of adding additional processors appears much lower than adding additional processors on the Xeon platform, because the Xeon platform appears to pessimize many of the synchronization primitives that occur for multiprocessor operation. If this were a Xeon picture, you would see a more substantial drop in performance by going to the SMP kernel. The blue bars are an idealized performance. This assumes that each time you add a processor, you add just as much performance as you get by adding the first processor. And you'll see that it increased linearly pretty nicely. What I've done is also done a predicted improvement in performance based on adding additional processors with respect to the performance you gain from adding a second processor. So suppose that the improvement in performance from adding a second processor is based on a property of the application. That is, you add more processors, the application only gets a little bit faster. And so it increases, but it increases less quickly. And finally, we have a measured improvement in performance of this workload on this platform. And we see that the performance does, in fact, go up as you add processors up to the third processor. And then when you add the fourth processor, it drops to the floor. And the reason for this is that SMP systems are improving only one resource. They're adding CPU capacity. So there are a couple things that get in the way. One of them is that applications may not be able to support more parallelism than you offer. They may, in fact, behave badly when you start adding more parallelism than they can use effectively. Another is, as you add processors, you're actually increasing the overhead of running the system. The operating system has to do more work to keep the processors in sync and communicate between them and so on. And so there's a lot more noise going on, and that impacts the productivity of the system. And finally, there's contention on shared resources. And I list I/O and bus, but in fact, probably the biggest resource is memory. And as you increase the number of processors sharing those resources, the amount of the resource available for each processor goes down, and that becomes an issue. So we can speculate a bit about why performance drops off when we get to the fourth processor there, and I'll talk about that in more detail a bit later. But that kind of picture is not unusual. If you look at various operating systems and increase the number of processors, where the drop-off happens varies, but you know, at some point you're adding processors, and they're not helping, and so in practice they must actually hurt. So there are two easy steps to make an operating system run on SMP. First you have to make it run, and then you have to make it run fast. Or maybe life is a little bit more complicated than that. There are two things you need to work on. You're kind of interested in getting a kernel to run the SMP system so that you can actually go out and run the application. Then you're going to start running the application on SMP, and you discover that, well, the work you did on the kernel wasn't so good, and the application really behaves very poorly. And so there's actually a pretty iterative process in which you get the initial version working, and then you're going to repeat the process. And I'll tell you about SMPNG is a bit of that repetition. So what I'd like to talk about most in this talk is the changes we've made to the FreeBSD kernel in order to get it to run a multiprocessor system. And there's a bunch of different things you have to do to get it up and running. And that includes the iterative improvement of performance as you move along. One of the most important things has to do with data consistency. So the primary resources shared between processors on SMP system, you know, what makes it SMP is memory. Almost all communication between the processors happens through shared memory. And so one of the things that you need to do in order to have that work is you need to maintain data consistency. When multiple processors are accessing data in shared memory between them, you have to make sure they don't corrupt the data structures. And so one of the things you have to do is adopt a programming model that allows you to maintain data consistency as part of writing sections of the kernel. I'm also going to talk a little bit about applications and what you have to do to make applications run on this environment. That's not going to be the focus of this talk, so I'll just talk about it very briefly now. So in order for SMP to actually be useful, there has to be some parallelism in your workload. There has to be something that you can do at the same time as something else in order for it to be benefit. Otherwise, you're just adding overhead. So there are really two kinds of parallelism that you'll tend to get out of this. The application itself may run in parallel with multiple CPUs. It may have to be performing computation on two processes and may gain performance as a result. But it may also be running in parallel with the operating system that has to do work to support the application. So in a bridging, filtering, firewall kind of environment, the operating system is doing most of the work in the kernel. So you want the kernel to be able to run on multiple processes at a time and supporting the application. But if you're computing large physics work sets on multiple processes, the operating system mostly has to stay out of the way. It has to provide primitives to allow them to talk to each other safely and otherwise stand off to the side. So depending on the workload, it may become more of an issue with the application or more of the operating system. But we want the operating system to support the application. Since threads are one of the important ways that we expose applications to multiprocessor, it's very important that the system have a good threads library. And one of the things that was missing in FreeBSD 4X and earlier is a threads library that really supports multiprocessor well. And so that's one of the areas that we had to see improvement in order to get SMP NG off the ground. So one of the other things I have to point out is beyond the kernel work I'm talking about, there's actually a lot of infrastructure that has to happen in all the supporting libraries in the system in order to get them to behave well in a multiprocessor environment, which is something I won't be talking about. So first let me tell you a little bit about bootstrapping, which is the first thing you have to do in an operating system to get it to run. As I said, you can usually boot a uniprocessor operating system on a standard off-the-shelf SMP system. It'll start up, you see one processor, and things are pretty boring. So one of the things you have to do is go out and discover the additional processors, and the process by which you do that varies a lot by hardware architecture. You may be able to ask ACPI what's there. You may have to go grubbing around. You may ask open firmware on some platform. But once you've done that, you need to go start them up and running, which means you have to initialize context for each one of those CPUs, and you have to arrange them and have some work to do. So this is a pretty boring part of the SMP process, but it's a pretty critical part. The next thing we should probably talk about is inter-processor communication. And there are really two kinds of inter-processor communication on desktop and server SMP boxes, sort of in the 4 sort of 16 processor range. Those are inter-processor interrupts and shared memory. I'll talk about inter-processor interrupts only very briefly. Basically, you use them to wake up the other processors when you boot. And then after that point, you use them to notify other processors of exceptional conditions or events that they need to wake up and go do something different. And if you're familiar with interrupts on a single processor architecture, they usually notify you that the application has done something wrong, that a timer has gone off, a hardware event has occurred. And they're basically handled in pretty much the same way in a multiprocessor system. So it's a way to interrupt another processor and say, hey, you need to go off and do something. You need to schedule another process to run. I've woken up some event. Something is going on over here. You need to go off and do some work. There are some challenges to getting this right. And one of the concerns is deadlocks. When you're delivering interrupts between processes, they are actually disabled when you disable interrupts on a processor. And so if two processors try to deliver APIs to each other at once, and they both have interrupts turned off, and they're both waiting for the other processor to acknowledge it, then you'll actually deadlock the system. All the processors will be busy waiting for each other. And this becomes a substantial problem in virtual memory, where you do a lot of APIs for something called a TOV shootdown, where you're changing properties in the virtual memory system. So the other one that I'm talking about a lot more is shared memory. Generally speaking, on operating systems like FreeBSD, when you run the kernel on multiple processors at a time, they actually all see the same kernel address space. And there may be minor variations in that address space across processors, but on the whole, it's the same. So memory is the big way in which we're moving data between the processors. And this requires you to have a consistency and synchronization model, and that's usually built up from primitives provided by the hardware, like atomic instructions. So you use atomic instructions, but you're also going to build a consistency model on top of that using high-level primitives like mutexes and condition variables. Another thing that you need when you run the system on multiple processes at a time is an expression of parallelism inside the kernel. In a single processor operating system, it's possible just to have basically a single thread of execution that starts and stops and takes brief breaks when the user process is run. This is not something you can do on an SMP operating system if you want to get the kernel running on multiple processes at a time, because you need a model for describing parallel execution. And the way we usually do that is using threads, very much the same way a multi-threaded application will do that in user space. Each thread could run on one CPU at a time. It might migrate between different CPUs depending on the model you're using. Some threads might be pinned to a specific CPU. For example, if you have per CPU idle threads, there's no point in migrating the idle thread to other processes. But there are actually other good reasons to pin threads to processors. And one of them is that that guarantees that data you're accessing on the same processor it's something you can access consistently, especially if you disable preempt. So there are actually some very good reasons to pin preempt processes. You can pin workloads to particular processes so that you get effective cache initialization for the workload. All execution in a thread is serialized with respect to the thread. So the thread is going to see events, events that it generates happen. It sees them in the event in the order that they occur. And this is pretty important and allows us to make some guarantees. And as I mentioned, one of the important design choices is when you decide to move kernel threads between processes. If two threads are doing all the work and they're sitting on the same processor and you don't ever migrate one of the threads to another processor, you're not really getting the benefits of SMB. You're doing all the work on a single processor and the other one is sitting there idle, which is no good. Probably the single largest issue in making the FreeBSD SMP engine work, actually happen, is data consistency. Some data structures will be accessed by more than one processor at a time. You really don't want treading them. You don't want them treading all over each other, causing data corruption inside the kernel. So you need a consistency model. Otherwise, you get something called a race condition, in which two processors access the same data structure and they leave it in an inconsistent state. And depending on the nature of the race condition, it may happen all the time, or it may happen only once in a blue moon. And so debugging an SMP kernel is often about detecting bugs in your data consistency model or the implementation of various things using the data consistency model. And as I mentioned, you usually implement your data consistency model or programming model using low-level primitives like atomic operations, IPIs, and so on. And what we've done in SMPNG is implement a set of synchronization primitives and so on top of these low-level services so that you don't have to use those directly, because they're quite complicated to use correctly in the more general case. There are also a lot of other data structures. There's been a lot of research that's done on how you do SMP efficiently. There's been work on lockless queues and so on. We do not make extensive use of lockless data structures in the FreeBSD kernel right now. The choice of model is very important, not only because it affects performance, but because it affects the complexity of the system that you're building. If you have a fine-grained approach to locking on multiple processes, your system can become very complex. And so if you choose a very simple model, you can get the system running much faster. And in fact, that was the approach that we took with FreeBSD. FreeBSD 3 and 4 use an extremely simple data consistency model for the kernel. They stick one giant lock around the whole thing. In FreeBSD 5 and 6, we use a much more complicated approach, and the result is that there is the opportunity for many more bugs. Maybe there's more than the opportunity for many more bugs. So, spend a lot of time debugging this stuff. So let me tell you a little about giant lock kernel, because this is where FreeBSD 4 started out before SMPNG kicked off. So this is the easiest way to get a uniprocessor kernel to run on a multiprocessor system. Basically, what you're doing is you're restoring the assumption that the kernel was running on a single processor at a time. You do this by sticking a spin lock around the kernel. Only one processor is allowed to enter the kernel at a time. If a second processor tries to enter the kernel, it has to wait. And it'll wait until the first processor leaves the kernel, and then it can go ahead and enter. So there's some, this restores the assumption. It makes life relatively simple, and there's some paperwork you have to do to make this happen. But it's pretty straightforward and not a big step. The key is that you allow user processes to run on more than one processor at a time. So you are getting more work done than you were doing with a single processor. If your workload is very intensive in user space, that is, most of the work is happening in the user processes, you may actually get quite good parallelism and you may accomplish a lot of the goals of getting SMP up and running. In fact, many people run SMP on FreeBSD 4 and FreeBSD 3 and get substantial performance improvements as a result. However, there are some problems with this approach. And that problem is primarily contention. You can spend a lot of time waiting for the kernel to become available. So I'm going to show you a picture of two processor systems. And we're running code on both processes at the same time, because they're running the user processes. And what they're doing is performing a series of kernel activities that are relatively unrelated to each other to illustrate one of the concerns about contention. And that's when the first processor, process 0, enters the kernel for a read system call, it acquires the giant lock. So when you move from green to blue up there on the top line. And for the duration of that execution, the second processor cannot enter the kernel. So when it makes a system call socket in this case, which is not very related to read on a disk, it will have to wait, this red region here, for the kernel to become available. When a giant is released by the first processor, then the second processor can go ahead and go into the kernel, perform the socket, and the socket returns. But in that time, the I/O completed for the first processor, and so now it wants to enter the kernel to go ahead and finish processing the I/O. And so it has to go ahead and wait for the giant lock to become available. It waits a little while, and then it goes ahead and proceeds. And one of the things that's immediately clear from this picture is that you can spend a lot of time waiting for the kernel to become available. In fact, of these two CPUs, most of the time one of them is blocked waiting for the kernel, which is a good problem. So if you have a very kernel-intensive workload, you don't see much performance improvement, and in fact, you can see substantial performance loss by going to SMP. That said, this is not an unusual way to do a first-generation SMP implementation. So there's a Linux 2.4 kernel, largely into a giant log, and Linux 2.6 relies on a much more fine-grained logging approach to allow the kernel to run on multiple processes at a time. And likewise, that's what's going on with FreeBSD4 and the work that we did with FreeBSD5. So what is the alternative to this giant locked kernel? Well, we know that contention is a problem because we're sitting around waiting for this lock to become available. We have a bunch of user threads performing system calls. They're going off and bumping into the giant lock. Interrupts come in, and we have to delay processing the interrupt because it's holding the giant lock. It's all very bad. And so for the workloads that make excessive use of the kernel, this is a big issue. And the workloads I described here are pretty common. You know, if you're running a web server, doing a lot of disk I.O., you're serving multiple Apache processes, doing lots of network work, it's pretty painful. One of the things I think actually quite important to point out is that in a pure giant locked kernel, you cannot even change the user thread that is running on a picket processor without acquiring the giant lock. You cannot enter the scheduler. One of the other things that happens is that if you're running an SMB kernel on a uniprocessor box, you may actually be limiting your ability to preempt the kernel for interrupt processing, which is the problem. I was going to ask, you know, what do you want to do about this? Well, one of the strategies that you can use is to move to a fine-grained locked approach. And fine-grained is a spectrum of possibilities, so I'll talk a little bit about that. But the basic idea is that you decompose your giant lock into a number of small locks. The idea being that if independent work is going on multiple processors, it really doesn't relate, you know, between the two processes, there's really no reason one should have to wait for the other. So you're going to decompose giants into lots and lots of small locks. And the way this is done is you typically kind of organize it around subsystems and chunks of data that are related to each other. So for example, you might place a subsystem lock around an IPC subsystem. Or you might take a more database approach, and you might place locks around individual data structures. So only when they actually touch the same data structure do you run into contention. So usually what happens is you'll sort of start out with a very code-based approach because it's relatively simple to stick in locks around subsystems. And then as you begin to approach a more fine-grained approach based on data logging, it gets more complicated and you do a lot more work. The first place you might start is with your scheduler. You might put a single lock around your scheduler so that you can at least context switch and user space between threads and between processes without bumping up against the giant lock. And this actually turns out to help performance a lot, because if you have a bunch of different user processes doing a lot of CPU work, but not really hitting the kernel other than context switching, they can now do that without waiting for the giant lock. So context switching isn't stopped when you spend a lot of time in kernel doing file system processing. And usually, the details vary a lot by operating system. So operating systems often take the same general approach starting out, and then the details really differ a lot. So you usually also take an iterative approach to doing this. So obviously, the FreeBSD4 kernel with its giant lock is the absolutely degraded case of protecting all the code available using one lock. And then what you do is you gradually introduce granularity. You start with scheduler, get the scheduler running without it. You move on to a bunch of common dependencies like memory allocation, things that a lot of different kernel code is going to want to run at the same time. You move into subsystem locks, and then you move to database locking. And usually, the process by which you move towards finite granularity needs to be based on measurement. The reason for that, and I'm going to go into this a little bit more detail in a second, is that locking is not free. You pay a cost for every synchronization operation, and depending on your hardware architecture, that can be a really significant cost. So if you overlock the system, you know, you go incredibly fine-grained, you have lots and lots of locks, and you're grabbing and releasing them all the time as you do work, your system will spill into a scroll. That probably stop. So you want to drive the movement towards finite granularity based on performance measurement. You want to add more granularity when you discover there is a contention problem. So just to sort of contrast to the picture that I showed you earlier, here's a picture of what might happen in a fine-grained lock kernel. We are grabbing and releasing lots of locks, but you're doing it based on data structures or based on what's happening. So as long as the two processes aren't coming in conflict with each other in terms of the subsystem or data structure they're accessing, then they're actually not going to contend. So we, in fact, make it all the way through the workload that was in the previous slide, through the socket and the read on the previous one and so on. We go ahead and perform the I.O. There's no contention. But finally, we hit a bit of contention down here at the end because both of them try to perform socket operations on related sockets, and so we aren't into a lock. And so contentions do exist, but in this idealized world, there's a lot less contention. And you only get contention when they're trying to access data that actually needs to remain synchronous. So this is the idealized picture, what you get at the end of the day. So the goal of SMPNG was basically to do this for the FreeBSD kernel. I guess it began in around 2001 or 2002 or so, and it's 2000, 1999, I don't know. It began a long time ago. And basically, what we have in FreeBSD5 and FreeBSD6 is a result of this work. There were several architectural goals. I'll talk about more about the aspects of these in a moment. One of the goals was to move to a more threaded kernel architecture. Threads are the way in which we represent parallelism in the kernel. So if you want to have parallelism in the kernel, activities must occur in multiple threads. And the way in which you assign work to threads is very important. And I'll talk a little bit about the approaches we use for assigning that work in a moment. Another of the changes we made was to move it so that interrupts actually get processed inside threads. which means they can be scheduled on multiple processes, they can be assigned parameters, and so on. This is one of the necessary steps in order to make it so that we can acquire locks inside threads, inside interrupt handlers. Otherwise, if you're sitting on another thread stack, that thread may already own locks and you may run into bad situations. So this is part of one of the necessary steps to get there. I'll talk a little bit more about that also. We went out and introduced a bunch of new synchronization primitives. The synchronization primitives in FreeBSD 4 were present, but they were mostly there to deal with the situation where the kernel, you know, one thread of control in the kernel, gives up control to wait for something to happen. And so they're what we call a sleep lock, a lock that can be held over the kernel sleeping, waiting for something to happen, like a disk I/O. So we had to introduce new primitives in a number of places. And what we did generally was derive these primitives from what people might be familiar from pthreads, where you have mutexes and condition variables. This is very similar to the approach taken in Solaris and a number of other systems, some of System 5 work and so on. And then what we did was iteratively walk through kernel subsystems, breaking them out from under the giant lock, providing at first maybe the minimum locking necessary to get them out, and then moving into more detail. In some cases, we jumped immediately to database locking. In other cases, we started out with a subsystem, and then we've been refining as necessary. And what we want to do is just pull giant off bits of the kernel one at a time. And every time you pull giant off a bit of the kernel, pieces of the kernel that depend on giant get less contention. So, you know, even if you haven't taken giant off the file system, you actually see a benefit from getting giant off of other parts like the network stack. And of course, we started with common dependencies, things that were relied on by many other subsystems. So, about FreeBSD kernel, well, first thing you should know is it's several million lines of code. So this is not a small piece of software. It has a lot of very complex subsystems. It has virtual memory, it has many file systems, it has a network stack, you know, implements many different network protocols. We have a lot of different types of IPC. This is not a small undertaking, and this is one of the reasons why it's taken what must be, you know, at least 4 years. In FreeBSD 5X, most of the major subsystems, with the exception of VFS and some device drivers, are able to run without the giant lock. This means they can execute in parallel multiple processes. Sometimes one subsystem can execute on multiple processes at a time. Sometimes the subsystem executes on only one processor, and you get parallelism with other parts of the kernel, but not within that subsystem. We've been working our way through device drivers. We've been working our way through VFS and the parts of virtual memory that are relating to it. But this was actually a pretty major accomplishment. In FreeBSD 6.x, we're doing two things. We're getting the VFS file system code out from the giant, and we're refining the locking approach that we took in FreeBSD 5. So if you remember at the beginning, I said get it to run, and then get it to run fast. FreeBSD 6.x is really about optimizing and improving what we did in FreeBSD 5. So we're dealing with a couple of the remaining subsystems, and then we're really cleaning up and improving what we've done. Let me tell you about the network stack. Network stack is also not a small piece of software. Over 400,000 lines of code, excluding distributed file systems and all the network device drivers. There are a lot of abstractions. There are a lot of different services. And we have memory allocators that are specific to the network stack. We have piles and piles of device drivers for, you know, literally hundreds or thousands of different network drivers are available. We have implementations of IPv4 and IPv6. We have implementations of IPX, the AppleTalk pieces. We have an ATM stack or two or three. We have sockets and other abstractions that are visible to the application. And then we have an extension framework called NetGraph that allows you to dynamically compose network stack components in some really interesting ways. And as you can imagine, that makes life a little bit more interesting when it comes to performing synchronization on the kernel. So this is not a small piece of software. So here's kind of a high-level picture of how things fit together. Applications talk to sockets. Sockets contain buffers, which contain data, which is handed back and forth. In the bottom end, we have the mbuf allocator. Mbuffs are a data structure that holds packets, or packet fragments, or segments inside the FreeBSD network stack. And then in between, you have a bunch of stuff. You have network protocols like IPv4, implementations of TCP. These speak sockets on one end. On the other side, they tend to speak network interfaces. And network interface is an abstraction for what Ethernet card or a PPP connection or whatever it may be. And network interfaces are generally implemented by network device drivers. We also have a subsystem that does routing, keeps track of where packets should go, how you look it up, and so on. We have a service called NetISR, which is the dispatch of network functionality on the receive side of the network protocol. And the reason I bring up NetISR here, even though it's a fairly small piece of code, is it really affects how the network stack runs in parallel and multiple processes. And obviously, this is a very simplified diagram. So to give you a little bit more of a concrete sense of how this works, let me actually give you two examples of TCP send and TCP receive on two systems. So on the left-hand side, we have the transmission path through parts of the network stack. On the right-hand side, we have the reception path. And what I've done is broken out in a couple of abstract levels. We have the system call and socket code, TCP implementation IP, and then the link layer. So as you transmit, you make a system call called send, which calls into a common routine called consend and implement various variations on the send code. And what it does is it goes ahead and stuffs it into a socket. It says, oh, I don't want to send on a socket, so we're going to call it a socket abstraction and provides the common implementation of sockets across various protocols, which appends it to a buffer and then hands the buffer down to the protocol. In this case, TCP knows about sockets and it knows about socket buffers, but it has to do a fair amount of other work in order to decide when to send data and when to transmit it. So it's working out of this abstract socket buffer. And eventually it decides it wants to send a packet, so it passes this down to IP output, which makes some routing decisions and figures out how to send the packet. It needs to get fragmented and all that stuff, which in turn passes it down to the link layer, which wraps it up in IP over Ethernet and sends it out to a device driver. In this case, it's the ESM driver, puts the start routine. And this causes a bunch of work to go off and happen in terms of PCI accesses and DNA and that kind of thing. So we've walked down a bunch of abstractions, and some abstraction layers are more complicated and deeper than others. When we walk up the other side, the packet is received by the Ethernet card, and interrupt handler goes off or runs, and if you're running calling mode, then once in a while you go off and you run the interrupt handler without interrupts. It walks up, it appears in the link layer, you pass it up to IP once you figure out it's an IP packet. You may perform some reassembly, you may just ignore it if you've already received the data, you may acknowledge it, you may do various other things, which passes it up to the socket buffer, you know, which is gradually filling in a completed stream of data so that it can be exposed to the application. And the receive system call will pull the data out of the socket buffer and stuff it into the user address space. If you're running in zero copy mode, it may directly map the data into the user address space, and likewise on the send side. So we have several layers of abstraction all stacked on top of each other. And although it looks neatly vertical in this case, I assure you that is not so. Protocol designs have neat layers and levels of separation that implementations don't, because the best implementations of network stacks know a little bit more than they're supposed to if they're neatly stacked like this. So the socket buffer code calls into TCP, TCP code calls into the socket buffers, TCP calls into IP, occasionally, you know, things head in the other direction. And in the link layer, this happens particularly badly. When you allocate memory to store a packet up at one of the upper layers, you kind of want to know what size of the headers are going to be in the link layer, so you don't have to allocate more memory later, so a little bit of reaching down. So some work happens there, but you know, this is the big picture of how things happen. So let me show you where this work actually occurs in threads. In the send case, we actually aren't a whole lot of threads involved. There's the user process, which as we saw before is in user space, the green, then it enters the kernel briefly, the blue, and then it returns to user space. It makes a send system call, pushes it down to the socket buffer, pushes it down, in this case, to UDP, pushes it down to IP, goes ahead and starts the Ethernet interface. So all of this is happening in this one thread representing the user process. And then it returns to user space. And sometime later, the Ethernet device decides it's sent packet. In this case, it happens while user space is running. So if we're a single processor, it will go ahead and preempt the user space process. The interrupt handler runs, it goes in and cleans up the memory, releases it back so it can be reused for something else, and then it returns, and then user thread keeps on running. So there's actually not much opportunity for parallelism in the send part. If you're running with multiple processors, the iThread could run on the second processor, the user thread could run on the first processor, but all the work, the vast majority of the work, pushing memory around and copying data in and out of user address space, all happens up there. So that's an opportunity for us to do something on SMP in order to make it run on multiple processors. Now let me show you the receive part, which is a little bit more complicated. Actually, this is mislabeled. Up there, I should say it's entering the send system call, not the receive system call. So you're in user space, you enter send, you call into the socket layer. The socket layer goes ahead and passes it down to the protocol, but it discovers that it needs to... I'm sorry, we're actually in the receive code. I'm confused. The receive code wants to go ahead and receive from the socket. It calls into the socket layer and says, I want to receive, I want to wait for data to appear in the buffer. And no data is available. So it has to block and wait for data to become available. And so we actually become idle at this point. So we walk down to the idle thread. At some point, some data is going to arrive. And when that happens, the Ethernet card is going to throw an interrupt and the iThread is going to start running. And the iThread could run on, you know, one of a number of CPUs. And it will go ahead and perform the link layer processing. So it'll figure out that it's an Ethernet frame. It'll look at the Ethernet frame and figure out that it's an IP packet. And then it'll go ahead and pass the IP packet off to the NetISR, which is the thread that performs inbound network processing. NetISR runs, looks at the IP packet, decides that TCP does a bunch, or sorry, UDP does a bunch of UDP processing and UDP input, and then passes it off to the socket layer. And then the user thread wakes up. And so this can actually be happening on multiple processes at the same time. So the workload over here in receive, where you're copying the user space, can happen at the same time in pipeline with other UDP packet reception. So there is the opportunity for parallelism here. So there's a bunch of concerns you have when you add locking and parallelism to the network stack. You don't have to run it on a single processor, even a single thread. The first is per packet costs. When you add synchronization to data structures, you're adding expensive operations, atomic operations. And depending on the type of processor you're using, it can vary in performance. So on a P3 processor, synchronization was relatively cheap, but still very expensive compared to normal instructions. It might be 100 cycles. On a Xeon processor, you're talking about a couple hundred, 400 cycles for some of the operations related to synchronization. So it can be quite expensive. If you do this once per packet and you're processing a million packets per second, it's not pretty. So the results can be much more expensive operation. Another important concern is ordering. In the network stack, you have to maintain ordering of packets relative to a particular source because protocols are very sensitive to misordering. For example, TCP, when it looks at misordering and acknowledgments or unreceived packets, can decide it reflects a packet drop. It hasn't seen the next packet yet, it's looking at the current packet, it'll say, oh shoot, must have dropped the intermediate one, better retransmit. This can cause very bad things to happen, even if you only misorder packets once in a while. So you have to maintain ordering across processes, even if you're operating in parallel. Another issue is that optimization can conflict. If you're optimizing latency in the network stack, then you may in fact be hurting throughput or vice versa. You want to try and do workload in batches, which increases latency, reducing the locking costs and so on. So it's a very careful balance to try and keep them both in line. Another issue with locks is lock ordering. And I've not delved into this in great detail, but suffice to say the big issue is deadlock. Two processes holding opposite locks try to acquire each other locks, and they'll both wait indefinitely for the locks to become available. And as a result, we use a lock order to prevent deadlock from occurring. And this has an impact on the way in which data is passed through the network stack. Layers that call into each other may have to drop locks and so on. So it's actually a fairly significant concern. So I'm just going to tell you at a very high level what the locking strategy is inside our network stack. On the whole, we use data-based locking rather than using a subsystem lock. In some places, we've used a subsystem lock, such as in Unix, Unix domain sockets. But on the whole, we've tried to use data locking wherever possible. In general, we don't have to lock access to packets themselves because they're processed in only one thread or processor at a time. But we do have to lock references to them. So if a packet is referenced by a queue, the queue has to be locked, so two processes don't pull the packet out of the queue at the same time and both try to act on that, which would be a problem. In general, with lock orders, protocols drive the behavior inside the network stack, calling into the socket code and so on. And so generally, protocol locks appear in the lock order before socket locks and drive locks so that they can call into each other without having to drop locks. As I mentioned, parallelism is a concern. If you have parallelism, then you can actually accomplish something on multiple processes at a time. So introducing parallelism is pretty necessary. There's already quite a bit of parallelism, as we saw in the receive part, because a bunch of threads are involved doing parts of the workload, which are actually a pretty nice split. Copying to user space is expensive, performing TCP is expensive, getting the data out of the driver is expensive. So those are things that potentially could occur parallel and beneficial. But we saw in the send part, there isn't a whole lot of opportunity for parallelism. So in some places in the network stack, if you want to take advantage of parallelism within the kernel, you may actually have to do extra work and modify the threading strategy. So there are a bunch of approaches to increasing parallelism. As I said, you know, our starting point is this giant free network stack that we have. So what you really want to do is select an interesting workload and look for places where CPU activity is occurring in a single thread, and you could potentially break it out in multiple threads so that it could run on multiple processes at a time. There are often some fairly natural boundaries in the network stack on where you might separate processing. And you saw earlier in the receive part that that's actually how it happens. The link layer processing happens in one thread, network layer in another thread, user application parts happen in another thread. So in some cases that happens pretty well. In general, it's protocol handoffs or layer handoffs because that's the point at which you no longer need to hold locks across the operation. Obviously, there are a lot of trade-offs. The more threads you have, the more context switching you do. Context switches are also not cheap, and likewise, locks can be quite expensive. Another challenge is mitigating the locking overhead. As I said, locking operations can be very expensive. If you do them for every packet, you require and release lots of locks, you're going to spend your entire time acting on locks. It's just not effective. So there are a bunch of ways that you can try and address that. One is to amortize the cost of locking. If you're delivering 20 packets to a socket and the socket has a single lock, then you want to try and deliver them all at once instead of locking and unlocking and locking and locking. And this is the way in which, you know, we're currently working primarily to improve throughput in areas where locking has increased the cost of processing packets. Another thing you can do is to try to reduce the number of locks. Maybe you overshot. You know, you use database locking and you discover that you end up paying more in locking because of that. And a subsystem lock actually worked perfectly fine on a dual processor system. And so that's one of the strategies you may want to use. Another strategy is that you can try and avoid locking entirely by using data structures that don't require locking, or by not spreading work over multiple threads or multiple CPUs. So sort of the inverse of the increased parallelism strategy. You can try and pin work to particular threads so that no synchronization is required. You can try and pin it to CPUs and use critical sections for preemption. Another challenge I mentioned is maintaining routine ordering. As I said, this is critical. TCP is dead. So the trick is to pick an ordering that makes sense. A really strong ordering will prevent you from taking advantage of parallelism, because there's the opportunity for misordering when the work is happening, you know, in odd rates between the different processes. Most systems start out by using source ordering, the order with respect to a particular source, and they assume that individual sources have to be maintained ordered, and different sources are ordered different, maybe ordered differently. And so, for example, sometimes we'll directly dispatch most of the network stack from inside the iThread. This is okay because an iThread is bound to a particular instance of an Ethernet card, and so it's processing those packets in order so the network stack will process them in order, even though other packets from other interfaces might be processed at the same time. So picking your ordering is important. The weaker the ordering you can pick, the more work can occur in parallel. The stronger ordering you pick, the less that you can actually do. So the general status of this work is that it is a work in progress. FreeBSD5 and FreeBSD6 both currently make use of the SMPNG network stack. FreeBSD5 is our, you know, one of our production, 5.3 is one of our production releases, 5.4 is coming out shortly, and it makes use of all of this. If you compile some more obscure components into the kernel, then you may end up with a giant lock over them, but in the common case, we won't end up with a giant over the network stack. What we're now in the process of doing is, as I said, moving from this philosophy of make it work to make it work fast, and the majority of the work we're doing right now really focuses on improving performance. And this means reducing the costs of locks in places where we found they were more expensive than we hoped. It means looking at particular workloads to see what makes sense. And it means looking at uniprocessor performance, where some of the changes in design and the philosophy and architecture of the kernel have impacted uniprocessor performance. In some areas, we see really significant improvements in performance. If you have lots of user threads or entering the kernel with copy data or socket buffers, you know, you have a web server and SMB, it can actually make a really big difference. But in other areas, we're seeing some performance loss compared to FreeBSD4, and right now we're trying to work through that. So obviously, optimization is one of the big things we're doing. So here's the summary. We did a lightning fast tour of multiprocessor systems. We talked about multiprocessor systems that were NUMA, we talked about SMP, we talked about the SMPNG architecture and the approaches you can use to make an operating system run on multiple processors. And then we talked about the network stack. We didn't talk about it in much detail, but we kind of did a quick trace through the behavior and how stuff passes between threads, how things move around inside the network stack, and so on. And we talked a bit about optimization techniques and strategies, things like where you can split work over multiple threads, where it doesn't make sense, where locking can hurt you, and per packet activities, and so on. And we talked about one of the big concerns, which is packet ordering, and how you make decisions about parallelism. So in conclusion, SMPNG is present in 5.x. You get it when you run it out of the box. 6.x is where we're doing the majority of our optimization work, but we are merging changes to 5. Some of them appear in 5.4. And here are a bunch of URLs, including the NetBuff webpage, which is about post-SMPNG optimization, and my own personal NetBuff webpage, which includes more patches than you really want to look at, as well as a log of the technical work that's been going on. So if you're interested in kind of the history of things and how decisions are made and what interesting problems you've run into, there's actually a fairly detailed journal of changes as time goes by. So that's it. Because I ran over a minute, I don't have time for questions.
So, any questions?
I have one question about TCP offload agents. If you have to take that into account, where's that? Because the TCP stack, of course, is one trick now. If you have a single network card in the SMP system, where do the TCP offload agent and the API for the kernel that's. The TCP ice. Is that, does it take into account that you can have an offload agent in your network card?
Right now we do offloading with checksums and things like that. Those will happen. There's an API for doing that.
Yeah,
we don't
it's quite a huge bit of the TCP stack that you can offload today.
Yeah, right now we have not done a whole lot of work of offload of all of TCP. We rely on basically checksum offload, some fragmentation related stuff.
Yeah,
we do a score for IPsec offload. Yes,
but when you eventually get there, will that affect how your SMB part of the kernel, or is that just transparent because of the stack itself?
I think probably largely not, and the reason is that in our current TCP implementation, we use a database locking scheme where individual TCP connections actually have a single lock during TCP processing. And so even if the model for the implementation of the details of TCP changes, we'll probably try and maintain that locking strategy, which continues to use a single lock to detect the state. And so the real question when we do TCP offload will be, how do you pass that information up and down the stack you know, how do you do that? And so I don't think it will substantially affect logging. In fact, it'll probably make life a lot better because you're doing a lot less work while you're holding various TCP logs.
Okay, by choosing that one, you don't see any difference by having two network cards, both have an offer and only have one. You don't see any difference.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with how. Yeah, I'm not familiar with how the TCP offload work is going to deal with managing, say, the TCP connection, so I don't know what the impact of that will be.
Okay. More questions?
I would like to ask if how do you test and make sure that your logs actually works and that you don't have any race conditions and so on?
Yeah, that's a requires a detailed answer, and I kind of avoided going into any details here. We have a bunch of things going on. They range from a lock order verifier inside the kernel that runs live on the kernel in a debugging mode and tracks the use of all locks to make sure they're being acquired in the right order, they're not held over sweep operations and things like that. In some cases we use a hard-coded lock order, in other cases we do dynamic construction of lock order based on runtime observation, so that helps to debug issues with deadlocks and so on. Make extensive use of lock assertions, that is, whenever we have use of data structures and so on in the network stack, we'll assert the necessary locks. And we've actually done some work to identify, and I've done some work to look through the kernel and dynamically compile assertions in around the use of particular data structures and the use of particular fields inside data structures. That doesn't protect you against all kinds of race conditions, but it actually goes a long way towards making sure the implementation is correct. One of the strategies we generally use in SMPNG is that we are willing to hold locks over cores between subsystems as long as the relationship with the subsystem is right way around. And so we actually try to avoid releasing locks during processing where it's avoidable and doesn't really have performance to do so. And the result is that a lot of the possible openings for race conditions remain closed in as much as possible. In terms of testing, what we've recently been doing over the past maybe 6 or so months is we've built something called the NetPerf cluster, which is a test cluster where we have a fairly large set of SMP machines being used in a variety of network workloads. This is something that previously developers could check out and remotely access as power cycling and network booting and all kinds of things. And you can set up network topologies to test the interaction between different machines. And so we have various test suites running. And one of the people who's actually helped us debug a lot of SMP problems in this room, Peter Holm, who runs an very interesting set of workloads and tests, especially on slower systems with less memory. One of the situations in which race conditions really open up is in low memory conditions, where you can't allocate the memory you need immediately, so you may go off and sleep and go do something else. And so we've done some work to try and improve testing there. I'd say we're part of the way through the process towards moving towards more formal SMP testing, but there's a lot of non-determinism in testing network stacks. Interrupts come in when they don't come in, and so on. One of the things we try to do is open up races by slowing sections of code down in order to open up the race conditions. We can turn preemption up to very high levels. We have a kernel option, I think it's called full preemption, but I think it maybe is more accurately referred to as foolish preemption, which will attempt to preempt the kernel whenever possible as a result of things like priority changes and threads moving around. And as a result, it becomes easy to identify a fairly broad class of race conditions. Things fall apart quickly if you have a lot of bugs. So we have tools like that and things like injecting failures in memory allocation and so on. So it's an ongoing process.
We have time for one more question.
No? All right, thank you very much.